Today, as I said before, we're going to be talking about book publishing, specifically university book publishing on Media Matters. And in our studios joining me today for the show, I have Bill Regeer, the manager, director of University of Illinois Press for the past 3 years, and Joan Catapano, the editor-in-chief of University of Illinois Press for the last couple of years, to talk about book publishing in general, because you both have long and storied careers in academic book publishing, and what changes are taking place there. And I think that we're in a midst now for all of book publishing, but especially university book publishing, of dramatic changes in sort of the business model, with striking effects on the sort of books that are getting published, that will get published, and quite interesting and perhaps startling implications for the quality of our print culture in the years to come. And that's what we're going to talk about today's show. And let's start. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Pleasure to have you here. Let's start by giving a little bit of an overview of just the book publishing industry. Because I think a lot of our listeners probably read books. I hope they do. Mine, at least, and yours, buy books and are experienced with books. But they probably, unless they're authors, don't really understand sort of how the industry is structured. You've got, on one hand, a series of commercial houses that publish a lot of the books, and then you've also got what are called university press books. How does the system work? What percentage is done by university press books of the books that get sold? What percentage by the big commercial companies? What are the differences between them? Between a university press and a commercial press?
Well, the standard answer to the number question is that we publish about 10% of the new titles every year in the United States.
Really? That many? That's pretty impressive.
But that only accounts for 1% of the annual sales. And you can directly interpret from that that we have to work harder to produce more, and that the market for much of what we publish is small.
Mm-hmm. So the commercial houses do about 90%. Now, how many big commercial book publishers in the United States are there at this point in time? Do you know? I'm not going to give you an exam on this or grade you, but roughly.
Well, Bob, it's just that I'm smiling because you know better than I do most of these questions dealing with commercial
publishing. Maybe I will grade you then. So you better watch it, Bill.
There are any number of imprints, but the number of owners of commercial publishers are few if you consider the imprints that are most likely to appear in the chain bookstores and the major independents. There are a great number, thousands of small presses that are not commercial presses, but they come and go rather rapidly, and few of them endure without either being absorbed by a larger press or having the owner decide it's not worth the trouble.
Joan, I mean, how long have you been in the book publishing industry, roughly?
Probably about 20 years now.
And always in the university press side, or have you done commercial?
Always with the university,
Press. So. Now, the commercial side, we'll get the university press in a second, but the commercial side of publishing, the big companies, has changed a lot in those 20 years, hasn't it? Weren't there? And I actually don't have the figures off the top of my head, Bill. Sorry to disappoint you. But I mean, there were a lot more publishers. It was a more competitive industry as recently as 20 years ago than it is today. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, Bill was saying there are only a handful of major sort of commercial presses left. And those aren't necessarily even just here in the U.S.
Let's put some names on this, because it sounds like, you know, Martians we're talking about in this. You've blanked out their names.
Well, Bertelsmann, for example, has absorbed
Random House.
Simon & Schuster, too.
Simon & Schuster is owned by Viacom, if I'm not
Is it Viacom?
Yeah.
But Bertelsmann has bought a whole group of them. And I think the only major U.S. independent is still Norton.
I think you're right. Little Brown is owned by AOL Time Warner.
It's in a division with the Random House Group.
So. I know. It sounds pretty bizarre. You can tell already how convoluted it is.
Well, it changes every week, too.
Well, it's also maddening because the title of the publisher you see on the title page isn't the corporation who owns it oftentimes. Mm-hmm. They've got a different imprint. It won't say Viacom or Bertelsmann. You've got to sort of look in the fine print of an SEC report to see the actual owner, who the person making the decision is. But how has that changed commercial book publishing, going from, you know, 20, 30, 40 publishers who each sort of are in the legitimate players down to 3, 4, 5 huge companies that dominate the market and really get pole position in the bookstores. And there are thousands of other publishers, but who really are very much on the margins or just scrambling to get anything into a bookstore. How does it change the nature of what gets published, which is really what matters to people?
Well, I think because so many former independent commercial publishers are owned by conglomerates who own many other divisions that have nothing to do with book publishing, their main interest and focus is the bottom line. It's not necessarily good writing or good scholarship, and therefore the subject areas being published, I think, become more and more focused on what's going to sell. Mm-hmm. So you see less and less being published in terms of new writers in the area of fiction, more emphasis on big-name authors rather than looking for someone who really just has an interesting idea and book. They're just commercial publishers are not risk takers.
That reminds me of a story. I gave a book reading a few years ago at a bookstore in suburban Washington, D.C., and the store was abuzz because the week before, Al Green, the great singer, had been in promoting his new book and doing a book signing. It was from one of these big commercial houses that had Al Green's memoirs. And everyone was excited because, you know, Al Green's wonderful. His music's incredible. And so the, one of the persons who worked there said to Al Green, well, this is great to have you here. By the way, how's the book? And Al Green said, well, I don't know. I haven't read it. I don't know if I'm letting something out of the bag. But I mean, it's just they hired the sort of franchise, the Al Green franchise, to like produce a book with his name on it. He could travel around. They'd sell a few hundred thousand copies. But it was, you know, it was purely a joke. It was a ghostwritten book. And it seems like what you were getting at also, maybe Bill, this is something you can talk about, is that in commercial book publishing, the blockbuster phenomenon has grown, where, you know, one huge hit can carry your prospects, and that's where the profits are. And the profits going from selling 100,000 to 2 million copies of a book, I mean, that's gravy. It's the first 100,000, you're just paying your cost. And so you were looking for the killer books. And those whole mid-range series of books, John, that you were talking about, that most new authors are going to get. Authors don't come right out of the starting gate selling 2 million copies. Never get published. So you have a whole group of authors then to sort of get left in the starting gates.
Jason Epstein, in a book that was published a year or so ago, said that even the bestseller phenomenon has changed in recent years, that it used to be that the best-selling novel was a loss leader. And mm-hmm. it would be priced and marketed at a cost and income where it might – sell tens and thousands of copies but still lose money, but it would help the prestige of the press to sell its other books. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That has reversed in our careers.
Yeah.
And the blockbuster phenomenon has mm-hmm. been the mirage that publishers, commercial and university, have been chasing with modest success.
I mean, one part of the problem, I would think, is that, you know, it's hard to do that for commercial press. I mean, I'm sure it's difficult to know what's going to sell 2 million. And you read in the trade press and sometimes even in the newspapers about a publisher that will give an advance to someone. It looks like this is going to be a great winner, a $5 million advance, and that's a total turkey. The book doesn't sell. And they're just out a huge amount of money. It's like in Hollywood. It's an enormous risk. You can't really anticipate what's going to sell. But I would think it would be an especially difficult thing when you get to the economics of university press where, you know, Tom Clancy probably isn't calling you up saying, look, I'm looking for someone to publish my next book. Not that you'd even want to, but it puts you in a tough spot because how do you make your pay the bills if you, in a blockbuster-driven industry, if you really can't do blockbusters?
Well, one other item we need to bring into the conversation is book distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, explain the importance of book distribution, because I think that's exactly the part of the industry that falls from view to all but people right in the middle of it. I mean, what do we mean by book distribution? Who does it? Why is it important?
It is more efficient for bookstores to order from a single place since they can cut their shipping costs and their overhead to get all of their books, no matter who published it, from a single place. To take care of that need, distributors grew up in the United States as they did in other countries, and the book distributors do most of the negotiation with the publishers for what discount the publisher and distributor can agree on. The distributor will do the original purchasing, and this will then determine what it will likely be the marketing emphasis on at the bookstore level.
So you're a publisher who publishes books, selling them to a distributor. And there are only a couple of them really in the country, major ones?
Three.
Three major ones. And then they're the ones who deal with the bookstores. And the bookstores are increasingly dominated by just a couple of very large companies. I mean, the independent bookseller has been like the family farmer of the last decade. I mean, they've just almost fallen off the map except for specialty shops like a feminist bookstore or a mystery bookstore or something like that. So you're really dealing with pretty tight spigots at the retail and distribution level.
That's right.
And that makes it that much harder then to get through because there's just, you know, the big guys get noticed first by those people, I would assume.
Indeed they do.
And so we're all – let's all go kill ourselves and talk about the decline of book publishing. But let's – before we do that though, we've got to do another 15 minutes before we consider that option. Let's talk about university presses because they are a different tradition than commercial houses. They weren't set up to compete with commercial houses. They were. Why do we have university presses? And what? I mean, you know, so how old are they? What was their purpose? When did they come along? I mean, you don't have the exact year, but
Well, the first university presses were Oxford and Cambridge University Press, which originally were started to print the Bible. And
that's going back a ways.
Yeah, it's back in the 16th century. Mm-hmm. And but the first American university presses were started in the early part of the 20th century. I believe Johns.
Nope. You were nodding your
head,
Bill.
Late 19th century? Was that early?
Yes, Johns Hopkins was the first.
Where I should add, you worked for many years prior to coming to the University of Illinois.
That's true.
And they shut down briefly and then reopened,
no,
right?
That's Cornell.
Oh, okay.
We're going to play around a Trivial Pursuit later.
Bill's
winning so far.
But even the early American university presses were initially instituted to publish the writings of the faculty.
Of their own faculty.
That's
so
right.
The idea was that University of Illinois Press would publish professors here in Harvard and Princeton and on and on and on.
I think they almost acted almost like the printing department of the university at first. I mean, that certainly...
Did they have the sort of rigorous review that university presses currently have for manuscripts, or was it... If you're a faculty member, you know...
They did have peer review, but books actually came later. The university presses began publishing academic journals.
Mm-hmm. When did the University of Illinois Press begin?
1913.
So it's been around as long as most of them. I mean, it goes back to the first generation then of university presses. I should say, so people will know what's going on here, we're talking today to the two people who direct the University of Illinois Press, John Catapano and Bill Regeer. It's my pleasure to welcome to the studio. To get them in, to fit into their schedule and mine, we're taping this show slightly before going on air. So today, please do not call in with your questions. Just sit back, turn up the volume, make a cup of tea, relax, let the professional yakkers do the yakking, and you can just consume today out there in the listening audience. So University of Illinois Press came along in 1913, and it has evolved now then for, 90-some years. And we have today how many university presses in the United States approximately?
Something like 80.
80 university presses. And they're mostly connected with the largest, best-known universities, research universities for the most part, aren't they?
I mean, that's
true. Wouldn't have like a community college doesn't have a university press or
No, they don't. Not that we know of.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't heard of it, they haven't sold many books.
There are a couple of very small ones. I think Trinity University in Texas just opened their press. That's probably about the smallest one I can think of.
And in the – is there a hierarchy within the university presses between sort of like the top dogs and then the middle dogs and the bottom dogs? Not officially, like, but unofficially or informally.
In terms of size or prestige?
Both,
or?
Either. Actually, yeah, size – both of those. I'd be interested in knowing.
They're somewhat related, of course, size and prestige. I mean, yes, there's a vast difference from the very largest press to the tiniest. Publishing maybe 3-4 books a year, a press the size of Chicago, which is actually the largest university press, is doing about 250 new books a year.
250 new books a year? That's major league.
But that is not anywhere compared to Oxford and Cambridge, which are doing 2,000 a year.
2,000. And by comparison, to give a sense, what will Illinois do in the fall 2002 list and spring 2003 list?
Well, we're doing about 140 a year.
That's pretty impressive too, though. And where does that put you in the rank of 80 in terms of number of books?
Among state university presses in the top 10.
And so going back to the question, is the top most – the biggest ones are Chicago. Who else would be the
– California probably second. Then you have a group of MIT, Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Johns Hopkins.
And that's sort of the first group more or less in terms of sales. And prestige too, because those all sound like fairly prestigious presses.
Yes, and it also has to do with age, that the older the press, the deeper its backlist.
Yeah, the backlist. Well, that might be a term most of our listeners are unfamiliar with. What do you mean by that, Bill?
Backlist and front list deal with two parts of our list that are defined by how recently we have published them. Mm-hmm. A backlist book for most presses is a book that is a year old or older. And front list is a book that is current up to about a year. A press that is doing its job well will develop a good backlist so that the books have a perennial audience and will continue to sell for years and years and not be dependent upon the sales of just the newest books.
Now, we're in a college town here, and I'm a college professor, as you know, and many of our listeners are either college professors or want to be college professors or related to college professors, and they all know college professors probably. University presses play a very important role in the careers of scholars, which is, you know, one of their functions. I mean, the publication of scholarly work is mandatory for promotion with tenure, for professional success in an academic career, which puts your press then as something of keen interest, all academic presses, university presses, of keen interest to scholars, because this you're the people who are going to publish the work for the most part. How do you handle manuscripts? How many manuscripts get submitted to the University of Illinois Press a year? Say we like, and how many of you end up running? What do you do when, let's say, Sally Jones from some PhD from so and so school sends you her dissertation or sends a revised version of her dissertation? And says, I want you to publish it. How do you handle that?
Well, first question: our rejection rate is something over 90%.
It's including a couple of mine in there, I hope.
No, in fact, we're the proud publisher of a Robert McChesney
book. I wasn't fishing for that, believe me. 90% rejection rate.
Yes.
Wow. Is that standard for major university presses?
Yes.
It should be.
It should be.
Yeah. I mean, they're, and I'm assuming in that 90%, you're including partial manuscripts too, because we don't we certainly don't invite full manuscripts right up unsolicited. What we do get unsolicited are many proposals, query letters, partial manuscripts, and we carefully sort through those to evaluate them in terms of the match with our editorial program and the value and uniqueness of the scholarship.
So a proposal comes in, then you send it out for what's called an outside review oftentimes?
Actually, the most important gate toward publication occurs at this point, and that's the acquisitions editor. The acquisitions editor will decide, first of all, whether the project as described is appropriate to the press. And then if so, try to determine what its merits are, how well-known the author is, how important the subject is, and by bringing a number of criteria to bear, determine whether or not to invite more. It is a rare case that a small proposal will be sent to a referee. Generally, you want at least sample chapters so the writing of the author can be evaluated. To go back to your original question about an unrevised dissertation, it is one of the major responsibilities of university presses to work with authors to revise dissertations so they become publishable. Some authors are very cooperative. Some don't understand the difference. And some presses have made it – university presses have made it a mark of prestige that they no longer consider dissertations.
Really? Can you name some names?
I would rather not.
Yeah, because that's they'll be getting some hate mail from graduate students all over the country if they do. Well, 90, has it been a 90% rejection rate traditionally for a long time? Is that standard, or has it gotten – do you have – overall, do you think it's increased or even lowered, or is that –
I think in my publishing career, it's been about that high. I mean, we just really are inundated with proposals. I mean, not always full manuscripts.
And almost always by academics. I mean, there's some independent scholars.
There are some independent scholars and local people who are wanting to do local topics.
I see.
Often they're just rejected because we don't publish in those areas. I mean, this is, you know, the 90% rejection rate isn't a reflection of, you know, the,
that they meet your standards.
That's
sure.
Right.
Yeah. What are the traditional strengths of the University of Illinois Press? Because you can't publish everything for everyone. If you're doing 140 titles, that leaves something out.
Bob, that actually ties in nicely with Joan's last comment that our function is not just to publish. That we are the publisher on the campus of the University of Illinois, and one of our major purposes is to advise the faculty of the University of Illinois about publication, not necessarily with us.
Oh, really? And so if a faculty member sort of has something they want to get published, a book manuscript, they can just come over and talk to you all?
Or make a phone call or
okay.
send an email. It is not unusual at all that we see a manuscript or a proposal that we think is meritorious, but it will deal with some subject area in which we don't publish, and we will then try our best to tell the author where the proposal could be sent.
So what are the strengths – what are the sort of proposals that are more likely to be direct hits for the strengths of the press and the interests of the press, John?
Proposals or manuscripts primarily in the humanities and some of the social sciences. Traditionally, Illinois has had a very strong publishing program in the areas of American history and American music, broadly conceived, labor history, African American history, and this sort of thing. The press made their reputation in those areas, and we continue to publish in those areas.
Now, what about library sales? This is something that I think gets to sort of the changes in the nature of academic book publishing. University presses, first of all, you're not a commercial enterprise in the sense that you're judged, Bill Regeer, John Catapano, you're not judged by how much profit you generate necessarily. Not to say that how you handle the books and making money isn't important, but then when you meet your maker, the number one thing there is they're going to say is, how much money did you make? How many books did you sell? But rather you're – in theory, at least, you're going to be judged by the quality of the books you produced and the quality of the research you fostered. I mean, it's a public service. It's not a commercial enterprise. So having said that, the business of academic publishing, a lot of it is dependent upon sales of books to libraries. And how important has it been traditionally and what's happening there?
Well,
and you're allowed to dispute my point about not being a commercial press if you
well,
so wish.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we're a division of the university and as such are a nonprofit.
Yeah.
But in many respects, we are among the lucky few, a university press that is appreciated and supported by its university. Many of our colleagues are suffering from the running university as a business model and are expected by their administrations to break even regardless of the publication list. It is more important that they break even or make a slight profit than that they publish important scholarship.
So that introduces commercial pressures then, so that the evaluation for what you publish moves away from being scholars assessing the quality of work and editors assessing the quality of writing toward what they think a market will purchase.
Exactly.
Sales. And that does produce a real conflict for the traditional mission of the university press, the role it plays in society. And getting back to library sales, I mean, because this is sort of a factor that's in there too. 15 years ago, when you published a book at Johns Hopkins or Nebraska or Illinois, how many library sales on average could you expect or 20 years ago for a university press book?
We haven't seen a curve. We have seen a set of falls, like falls from precipices in the last 20 years as libraries have had to face financial crises of their own. 20 years ago, a university press could expect normally to sell 1,500 copies of a book.
To libraries?
Yes.
Wow. Hardcover? Cloth.
Yes. Yes. But those were when books were $7.95. 10 years ago, that had been cut by 500 to 600. Mm-hmm. And presently, the number is very meager, hovering around 300.
Now, this is pure ballpark, so I'm not going to hold you to this. If you publish a book, everything else being equal, how many copies of that book do you need to sell, more or less, to get it in a range you're not going to be losing money on it? You know, I assume it's more than 200 or 300, I guess, is the point I'm trying to get at.
Well, we've had to accommodate our pricing to what we believe the actual sales will be. Mm-hmm. So we can come out even with an edition of as few as 800 copies.
But you price it pretty high then.
We have to price it high.
And that's really a lot of – people probably wonder why they go to a bookstore and they'll see some books that cost $45 and other books that cost $19.95. The 1995 books are being priced that way because the publisher is convinced they're going to sell tons of them, and that's a good price to put it at. And if even if you price that $45 book at $19, you might sell 900, not 800. It's just not worth it. Is that a correct way to put it?
That's absolutely right, yeah. The factors that go into establishing a price for any book are the size of the print run, mm-hmm. and the size of the manuscript or ultimately the book, and royalties play a small factor in there, if there are any royalties to be paid.
So is it harder to publish books then if you're losing? I mean, you're describing a situation where in 20 years you've gone from 1,500 to, say, 300 roughly. Library sales. I mean, a collapse of 80%. I mean, at 1,500, it sounds like not that it was risk-free, but you could publish a lot of books and not worry about, you know, you'd know you'd have a market built in pretty much through libraries. It gave you the freedom to take chances. You didn't have to worry about doing something a little different. And it gave you a lot more wiggle room as managing a press, as editing a press. Nowadays, a 200-300, I mean, you charge a lot more for the books, but if you got to sell 800 and you're only getting 300 at the library, and if to sell those 800, you're charging 40, 45, 50 bucks, you got to find 500 people who want to pony up that sort of money. I mean, that offhand, that doesn't sound like a great business model, to be honest. I mean, what sort of problem does that present to you, running a press, trying to do your public service mission?
University presses and commercial presses are always watching each other, mm-hmm. and there are any number of commercial presses that do specialize in academic publishing, and they are able to make livings and endure for decades by doing small print runs of very narrow but essential books.
Commercial presses,
yes. But most of these are in Europe, and they tend to be concentrated in the Netherlands and Belgium.
Mm-hmm. Does it hurt that sometimes I'll see major commercial presses in the United States, probably less frequently today, but I have seen it in the past, and several of them. You go to a history conference, you see it all the time. Major commercial presses will publish academic work too. And sometimes it looks like they might be cherry-picking the most lucrative stuff that, you know, you'd probably love to have in your list. It's really high-quality work that might sell 3,000, 4,000 copies. But that author then can make a little more money going to a commercial press. So you're left publishing the stuff that doesn't have the market built in. Is that a problem that you face?
It has two kinds of problems. Not only is there cherry-picking going on, but it raises the expectations from all academic authors about how their book should be published.
Yes. I wasn't going to go there. The issue of authors and their presses and the – is there any author on earth who's never felt that their press was not doing a good enough job selling their book? I don't think that author exists. I think that is a standard response, that the press is not doing a sufficient job selling my book.
I'd say that's typical, but it's not universal.
It isn't universal.
Our marketing department has received flowers from some of their authors.
No, and I think I'm one of them. They certainly did fine by me, but I think this is a standard thing authors always feel.
That it's true.
Never getting the attention their work deserves. Yeah. Well, you know, it sounds like Illinois is doing better in many respects than a lot of the university presses you hear about and read about, whether it's because you've done a great job or whether the university supports you or you just have a good backlist, whatever factors aside. But you hear about other presses that are really getting squeezed by this, that maybe don't have the backlist. They're competing for books and they don't have the prestige maybe to draw the authors, that they're losing the best research to more established presses. Are we going to have fewer than 80 university presses in 10 or 20 years? What's happening to the last 20 on the list who are really probably struggling with the low library sales, the ability to get good authors?
It's hard to know. I think that there are a number of smaller presses right now that are under this kind of pressure that they possibly might not be with us in the near future. Bill can tell you about the case of Iowa State University.
Well, I was going to ask about that because I picked up a book from – I reviewed a book for Iowa State University Press not too long ago. I thought that was their name at least at the time. And they sent me a copy of the book, and I sort of opened it up, and I look at the title page, and it says, like, Iowa State Blackwell. Mm-hmm. And what the hell is that? Heck, excuse me. What the heck is this? Iowa State Blackwell. I mean, is there a typo or something?
No, 2 years ago, in our eyes, an incredibly irresponsible thing happened at Iowa State, and the administration decided to sell its university press. And not only did they sell the press, that is all of its inventory and its physical assets, but they sold the imprint.
I mean, they sold the name, the reputation of Iowa State University Press to a commercial concern.
And that's
correct. They sold for an amount of money, they just gave it away.
That they thought was a very good sale for them, but to anyone in the publishing industry, it looked like a steal.
That Blackwell got away with murder.
They got away with They were very intelligent publishers,
yeah.
And they got a bargain.
They got a good deal. So it's like the city slickers going up against the country bumpkins. Not to pick on our friends over in Iowa. But is this a sign of what's going to be happening? I mean, it strikes me what you're saying is that if you have a university that expects its press to make money or at least break even. It's not willing to subsidize the press to do its scholarly mission, which is increasingly the rule at universities, which are not just doing that to presses but to all units. I mean, departments are being told you've got to break even. Libraries are being told that. Sports teams, every aspect. There's no – the day of subsidized public services is ending. Well, and your library sales are plummeting. This is not a very good picture, and it really seems to have striking implications not just for book publishing of university presses but for the whole scholarly system. What happens if instead of university presses turning out 8,000 titles a year or 10% of the books being produced, they're producing 5% in 20 years? And what's going to happen to all those people who have been – then the rejection rate goes from 90% to 98%.
It's going to be very difficult for – departments to make tenure and promotion decisions, I suspect, because it's going to be more and more difficult for young scholars to publish the first book. I believe the MLA has recently, the president, current president, has sent out a letter to this effect that, there is a crisis in scholarly publishing and it's perhaps the universities are going to have to rethink their criteria for tenure and this sort of thing, because some scholars in very specialized fields, I don't want to give you a field, someone will take offense, but, there may not be anyone out there willing to take a chance to publish in a very specialized literary field that, there are two or three departments in the country.
So the research could conceivably dry up there.
No, Bob, I think I have a different answer.
Okay, good.
To go back to Cambridge and Oxford, mm-hmm. if you consider what they have done to American scholarly publishing, and I'll be particularly severe on Cambridge, they came in with a target for publishing a certain number of books, and they have reached it. And
was it 5 million?
Well, 2,000 new titles per year.
And just in North America or worldwide?
Worldwide.
Okay.
But at 2,000, that represents a 100% increase in a decade. And between Oxford and Cambridge, those two university presses are publishing almost as much by themselves as all other American university presses.
Wow.
So the problem is different. The problem is that
they're the Microsoft of university publishing is what you're saying. He doesn't want to answer that.
Well,
but I can tell you he's blinking at me.
I'm trying to think over the analogies and let me try to make a couple of points about the implications of this as
Microsoft
I see it.
Okay.
If a press has a target like that, then the number of titles takes control of the list. And a press is more interested in generating more titles than it is in trying to do the best with the titles it acquires. There are press can still be a full-service university press, providing services that are generally invisible and often unappreciated until an author goes to a press that doesn't have them.
Yeah.
For instance, copy editing or proofreading.
Yeah, let me underline that as an author. I don't think until you've actually gone through this process do you appreciate the significance and importance of good copy editing and good proofreading. But there's nothing worse than to open a book and see typos in it. It's like someone's like a knife in your arm or something, because you know it'll never go away. And when you see great copy editing done, the way it just elevates a manuscript, it can take a pedestrian manuscript and make it sharp and clear and readable and make you sound so much smarter as an author. The lack of that is telling. But that's the place you can cut back, I guess you're saying, easiest, and it's less known to the public, so they're unfamiliar with that. And authors, if they're only dealing with a couple presses doing it, don't have quite the leverage to demand it because, you know, this big company's got 2,000 other books, you know, tough luck. Is that a fair assessment of the situation?
That's true. And to pick up your Microsoft analogy,
okay.
The pressures on authors to not only publish with an academic press but with the most prestigious that it can will naturally tend in the current environment to encourage them to send their works to Cambridge and Oxford before they send them to a smaller American university press.
I can say that from personal experience. When you're thinking about a book you're going to publish, you're saying, well, I want the widest possible readership and a university press. Well, you're going to gravitate. There will be an attraction to a big press with global distribution that you know will have entree to every bookstore and every book publisher. If you go to a smaller press, you might get more hands-on service and better attention, but you know maybe the book won't be available at that bookstore in Atlanta, Georgia, where your friends go, and they would see it if it was with that big press. And that, so it really does put the smaller press in a difficult competitive situation.
But that's because of the perception that a Cambridge or an Oxford treats all of their books exactly alike, which
yeah.
they don't.
Yeah.
The top of their list.
No, I've been at the bottom of the food chain at Oxford. You don't have to explain to me, because I remember when my first book was published by Oxford, and it's a wonderful press. I don't want any lawsuits here, but it was one that was not considered to be a big seller, and the initial typeface they were going to use for it was like microscopic. It was like a 7-point type because they wanted the cheapest, it was the lowest grade they had. And I'd fortunately put in my contract that they couldn't do that, so they had to upgrade it to a readable typeface because I knew they would do that. And I was an assistant professor trying to get tenure, so I wanted it Oxford on my CV. I mean, that was my first and foremost concern, not anything else. And I was lucky, or else I would have had an absolutely unreadable manuscript to show for it.
Well, many of these books, as you say, at the bottom of the food chain that an Oxford or Cambridge might publish, have print runs of maybe 200-300 copies and are priced at $75 to $90 or something of that sort. Those are not going into bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
They may appear in one big group ad, but that may be about all the promotion they're going to get. They also don't put out much money for a book like that in terms of design, typesetting, mm-hmm. probably even paper.
You know, there also is another side of this that's a great concern, is that fewer books are going to be able to be published, and there's going to be more of a concern at the eyes of presses to get books that will sell more, subconsciously if not consciously. University presses will have to think this way. Well, then scholars won't get stuff published in certain fields, so certain fields will dry up because there won't be stuff getting published. That leads you to think that we could have sort of commercial pressures entering in on what sort of research gets done, even more than we already have, in areas like humanities, which traditionally have been less susceptible to sort of coming in and paying for research. The stuff that's going to be sexier, the stuff that's new, that takes chances, that doesn't play on what people already know, is going to be harder to get through the gates, because that sort of stuff is, you know, if you just tell people what they already heard and use the same buzzwords, then people might not attract to it originally. It takes a little while to develop a taste, which would seem to me, maybe it's a rhetorical question, but an enormous loss for scholarship if that plays out in that direction, not that it necessarily will.
I think some of what you describe is actually, though, more easily published than more traditional scholarship, because I think some of the primary book buyers are graduate students or recent PhDs, and they're the ones who want to read all the newest and trendiest kinds of things that are going on. These usually kinds of projects often don't have a staying power, but will have an initial sort of surge in sales then drop off.
So, but then it's just playing to faddishness a little bit more than the quality. So just a faddish thing comes along. You do books, even though you're reading it as an editor, you're saying, oh, that's pretty lame. But I say, well, a lot of grad students are reading this in seminar. They want it. We'll publish it. You know, we won't lose money on it. And maybe there's, you know, that's what a better way to put it than the way I did. Bill, what's your experience with this?
Well, I think the entrance of marketing, or the increase in marketing and sales, has had deleterious effects in lots of ways upon university press publishing. We've talked about some of them, and most of them are going to be invisible and will only be appreciable when we see the statistics 10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
But an experienced author will want a university press to do rigorous peer review.
Mm-hmm.
And peer review is presumably important for every university book published and for every author published by a university press. But we know that what's really important for younger authors is securing their careers.
Yeah.
And it's more important for them to get positive readers' reports than helpful ones.
Yes, that's absolutely true. We're talking to Bill Regeer and Joan Catapano from the University of Illinois Press today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. We set it up to get everyone in the studio and the schedules would mesh, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and relax and enjoy the remaining minutes of the program. One thing that's been a big change in book publishing has been the Internet. And it's a subject of great discussion, perhaps a little less now. We'll talk about that in a second than it was a couple of years ago. But one immediate way it's affected book sales has been the rise of selling books over the computer, specifically Amazon.com, but other services as well. Has that affected University of Illinois Press? Do you have any idea what percentage of the books you're selling go out over Amazon, for example?
No, not really.
Because you sell to a distributor, so you don't. The distributor sells to Amazon.
Generally, I think the sale of books through the Internet is a positive thing. The Internet is able to fulfill needs faster and more generally for people. I use the Internet frequently myself for purchasing books. But the impact as a whole upon university publishing has been bad, but for reasons that were unanticipated.
Mm-hmm.
The buzz 5 years ago or 2 years ago was that the Internet would make publication a whole lot cheaper and that scholars would be able to publish their work in a way that would be more accessible to more people at a smaller price. Instead, what's happened is that the larger publishers have generated databases that include all of their books or some large part of their books and their journals, and then turned around to the same library market we've been discussing and sell the same thing to them twice, once as paper and again as a database.
Mm.
The increase in library purchases of databases has gone from zero to about 10% of their budget. And most, if not all of that, has been taken from the budget from the humanities and the social sciences for monographs.
Mm. So, you know, let me recount a story. 2 years ago, I was with a friend of mine who publishes a small commercial publishing house in the East Coast, and we've been friends for a long time. He's very interested in new technologies. And he told me that among his office staff, this is back in 2000, and now that sounds like you might be talking about the War of the Roses. It seems so long ago for what I'm about to say. But he had been talking with his office staff about how the Internet would affect book publishing. And he said the question he posed to his staff at the time was, when would the last print book be made? When would they all go online? And he wanted to have an office pool on this point. And he wanted to stimulate thought about it and discussion. And his own personal guess, and this was in June of 2000, was that within 2 years there would be no more print books made. And I gave him my, you know, Charlton Heston line, that they're going to have to drag my cold fingers off the print book. I mean, I'm going to be dead before they stop making them. That, you know, I couldn't imagine reading a book on a computer screen. But his argument was actually not dumb. I mean, he said if you look at the economics of it, that when you reduce the cost of the publishing and distribution and actually have a nice screen and software that makes it very user-friendly, a $20 book or a $30 book, you can get download and print up or look at one of these nice screens for one-tenth that cost, and the author still can make the same sort of money. That was his argument. And once people get that, you know, it's one thing to pay $20 to read it on a screen or $20 to get it in the bookstore, but only a moron's going to pay $20 to read it on the screen. But if it's $2 on the screen and you can print it up, or $20 in the bookstore, well, then you say, well, maybe I'll do the screen. Well, obviously, no one's – I mean, that's like one of the worst predictions of all time. I mean, we're, if anything, further away from that today than we were 2 years ago. I see no evidence that that's the direction we're going. But there was that moment, wasn't there, where they're talking about people walking around with these book gizmos and read books on their computer? Yeah, Joan, go ahead. You were nodding the most vociferously. Well, so you,
I follow discussion on some library listservs, and even they who have believed that books too would disappear. Many of them, not all librarians, have come to the realization that they're the costs of the people who prepare the materials for the electronic delivery is so high, and these are skilled workers, and those costs are not coming down.
So the layout, the software,
the coding,
making it presentable. It's not just like posting up a Word attachment or something.
That's right.
So that the cost, it's not going to be $2 for that book. It's going to be like $15.
$15, and then by time you print it out, it's not going to be very attractive, and you have to pay to have it bound and this sort of thing. The cost of the paper is probably going to be about the same cost as buying a book.
But in fairness, again, to my friend, who actually is a pretty smart guy, he has been in publishing for a long time. He said, well, the other thing that's going to happen is that in scholarly work, for example, and this is where it relates directly to the University of Illinois Press, you'll have, for where footnotes are, you can have links. So, you know, imagine what it's like to read a book with, you know, 1,000 footnotes like a great scholarly work will have. And for many of those, wherever possible, links to where you can go directly to the work itself. Imagine how wonderful, what a resource that is for a scholarship. And once that becomes readily available, then certainly it makes sense for scholarly works to shift as much as possible to a computer format. Has there been any discussion of that, or is that pure pie-in-the-sky stuff?
The leadership in this, again, has been journals.
Yeah.
And the experience of journals has, I think, also blown up the bubble that we were talking about a few years ago.
A bubble of
How less expensive scholarship will be on the internet.
You know, we should back up and talk a little about journals, because that really is a lot of the problem with libraries we were getting at earlier, is that library budgets for books shrunk because the cost of journals went so up that they had to use all their money on these journals, and then they had less to buy new books. And excuse me. So, and why – let's just talk about that for a second, then we'll get to this point. Why did the cost of journals go up so high in the 80s and 90s?
Because of consolidation of scholarly journals.
Into two or three companies,
that's
basically.
That's right. Again, based in the Netherlands.
But is this like a thing about the Netherlands?
Well, the Netherlands has a fabulous history in the history of publishing.
Uh-huh.
And a publisher named Elsevier took the name of a very famous publisher from the early years of publishing and renewed it in the 1930s, then began to acquire other scholarly publishers of journals in the late 80s and 90s, and now has so much control over academic journals, particularly in the sciences, the medical and tech fields.
And these are fields where the journals aren't – like in some fields, like the one I'm in, you can skip the journals. It's not the end of the world. But in science journals and some of these technical journals, they're absolutely the heart and soul of the discipline. I mean, you cannot be a participant as a scholar unless you have these journals and read them and publish in them and are immersed in them. That's where all the cutting-edge work is done. So when they raise the price, research libraries really don't have a choice. I mean, there's tremendous pressure to keep these journals. Is that a fair
– Yes. And two other things have happened to further erode the library budgets for the books that most university presses publish. One is the database phenomenon we've talked about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other is that the scientific community needs this material as fast as possible. So they've gone to preprint, where their materials appear online before they have actually been published.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this would be where you'd have the footnotes would have links then?
Not yet. Not yet. But not that yet.
Wouldn't – I mean, it seems like with the internet journals, print journals. I mean, books, I still want my books. But journals, you know, hey, I'll take those on the internet. Wouldn't that seem like Exhibit A to get rid of printing up all those journals that no one ever reads anyway?
Except for the need for archival copies. And a library takes it as one of its major responsibilities to serve as a repository forever.
Well, why can't they just email a copy and then the library can print up a really nice copy and bound it? Instead of paying $3,000 for the journal, pay $30 for it, and then they can just spend $20 making a nice-looking copy. You know what I mean? Because the costs are so low otherwise that it's just a monopoly of power.
I can't quite agree that the costs are low. I'm sure that because we're talking about profit, for-profit publishers, that the prices are considerably higher than they would have been if these same journals were being published by university presses.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking I've been paid a sum total of zero for every journal article I've written. So I know the labor costs can't be excessive for journals.
But the other thing that's happened in sciences is that the division or twigging of branches of knowledge has increased so radically in the last 20 years that the number of scientific journals has had to increase to deal with each of these particular focuses. And that, too, has increased the library budgets for acquiring journals.
So the irony here is that instead of lowering journal budgets, which they thought the internet would do because you could do so much online, it's in fact had the, if anything, the opposite effect, that budgets for libraries are even strapped more, which puts even more pressure then on book publishers, especially university press publishers.
So far.
Well, look, we've only got a few seconds left. Tell me something hopeful. We want to get off the suicide alert again. What is there going on that excites you about the future of university press publishing?
Well, the electronic developments are exciting in terms of using the internet, the web, to promote books, to reach your consumers directly.
Using the internet to sort of expand
our marketing capabilities.
Readership,
You know, as you said, the bookstores are now basically controlled by two or three chains and who are asking for exorbitant discounts to get the books into the stores.
We have to end on that happy note, I'm afraid. Joan Catapano and Bill Regeer, thank you very much for being our guests today on Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you. Folks who want to learn more about University of Illinois Press can just go to the website, which is the University of Illinois. Just go through uiuc.edu and learn all about the terrific books they're publishing. Thank you again. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. I'll see you next week on Media Matters.